All right, so first thing, just for the camera, can you tell us your name and how you were associated with the ECCC?
So my name is Neri Wook and I'm a Khmer French woman. I'm 44 years old. I live in Europe, and in 2004, Kofi Annan and the General Secretary of State started negotiating with the actual government, that is to say Hun Sen, and in order to bring to trial the most responsible judges of the mass atrocities that took place in Cambodia. So they were taking into account a restricted period ranging from 75 to 79. And as you may know, it still was a very sensitive subject at the time, all the more taking into account that there has been quite a number of Cambodians who left the country to escape the war after years of survival in the inside the country itself. And the diaspora spread all over the world. Like nowadays, there are American, for instance, but not only, of course. Myself, I live in France, so this is a little bit how it happened.
Yeah, we're certainly interested to hear. Like you said, there are quite a few people who left who are all around the world now. And we actually spoke to someone who works with civil parties based in California, who also were going through the same kind of things you did. So thank you for sharing that perspective with us. I think it's probably one people don't think about as often as the people who are still here.
If I can add, it's a kind of reminder. I mean, something we forget is the whole frame that happens, not only the story of each person, it's a whole something to organize.
Yeah, absolutely. So what prompted you to apply as a civil party? Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how you became aware of the trials and why you decided to become a part of it?
So how I was aware of the trial was during 2004 and 2008. The investigators started inquiring all over the country itself, and teams of lawyers edited a few number of articles in local newspapers, so above Cambodia, so to get in touch with any potential survivors who could apply as civil parties and be legally admitted, which is to say be able to prove who you are, which looks very weird, but this is how you have to do after a genocide, because not so many remain, not so many witnesses, be they perpetrators or victims. And that was the link with the genocide that occurred in Cambodia, actually, the way that investigators did their job and then tried to find people on the ground itself in Cambodia, but also above, as I was telling you previously. So especially in my case, it was a case dealing with the S21 purges. We had an article that was found in a local newspaper in La Rochelle in France, that was given to me by a colleague of mine at work. And the lawyer, Mrs. Rabesandra Tana, was sending a kind of warrant. She was looking for survivors in France to come and testify above. For us, it's above, I mean, from Cambodia. So to go to Cambodia. So of course, the problem, first problem was we had to go as family of a survivor to Cambodia, which is quite a challenge, first challenge. My mom had kept five big folders of papers relating to my dad. So there are many things inside of it. And she met Mrs. Rabesandra Tana, who asked to meet me as well. So I had to go there to drive to La Rochelle, from where I live, and I did this the same day I met her. And she said, we would like you to come to Cambodia as well. And my mother needed me to go to Cambodia because it was also quite a challenge for her to go back to Cambodia. We had been over there in 1991, and the experience had been very, very difficult.
Yeah, I can only imagine how challenging all of this must have been for your family.
It has.
Yeah. So, kind of maybe keeping that in mind, tell us a bit about your experience as a civil party. You know, if you can help us understand what it was like, you know, working with the attorneys there and then speaking before the court, we'd love to kind of hear how that was for you.
So I sent Mom the article I was telling you about. I was convicted by the lawyer in La Rochelle, and Mom contacted this French lawyer in charge, gave her all the documents about Kate, my dad, and in addition to those we had found little by little over the years, so that is to say pictures, letters, my father's degrees that he had passed whether in Cambodia or in France, personal postcards he has sent to us. We've been living in Africa, as you may know. Mm-hmm. And so my dad used to write down a lot of postcards to my mom and sending kisses to the whole family, the French family and so on. So he was always keeping contact, mostly through letters and postcards. So Mom had them copies of all kind of documents and interviews, interviews from S21 that we had done when we went there for the first time in 1991. So the country still was in a kind of civil war. It was an emotionally strong trip. And so we had kept documents from S21. Because during the visit, we had found new documents that the Red Cross helped us find. They found them, but after us, in fact, actually. So they sent the documents afterwards we had found them. But we gave this all to the lawyers. Mm-hmm. And so through those divert travels we had already done, and since the disappearance of Kate in 1977, Mom had already gone to Thailand in the refugee camps as well. So she had been given words from Ho Thong Hung she had met in the camps in Thailand. And we have words written down, things like that. So we gave everything to the lawyers. And in the end, the lawyers told me a week before that that I would also testify as a civil party. They told me that.
They only gave you a week? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, only a week, because I was just supposed to take my mother to Cambodia just to accompany. I said, I'm going with you, and you know, I'm going to be just to support her, you know. And she started to read the. I mean, everybody was reading in the trial. Everybody was reading a statement. And I realized that very quickly, because I've been witnessing behind the glass from another office inside the trial itself. And I realized very quickly that everybody was reading. And so, like everybody, my mom had written down her story, because it's long, it's hard to remember and so on. And she started reading in front of the lawyers, and suddenly she broke down, and I looked at her and I thought, oh my God, I have to take the paper. So I took the paper and I read instead of her what she had been writing down. And she was just, it was emotionally too much for her. So I realized that the lawyers looked at me and they probably thought we're gonna need them both, because one has lived the story a certain way, and Neri, maybe if one of the two breaks, then we have to have a second one, you know. I felt it was this.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and it must be a pretty different perspective to having had your husband go through this, but having had your father go through it when you were, I believe, if I remember correctly from your book, only 2 when he went back. So I can see how that would be quite a different perspective.
It's nothing, it's not the same experience, of course, though it's the same family.
Right, definitely. Hats off to you guys for going through all of that. I can't even imagine how much of an emotional roller coaster it must have been. I wonder if you can tell us, based on your experience, how well you felt like civil parties were supported by the court, and if there's any areas where you think perhaps things could have been improved, we'd love to hear about that.
To start with, we had several discussions with our team of lawyers. They had to understand the story of Cambodia, because they were coming from foreign countries themselves. So we had Mr. Cannon, who was French. We had French lawyers indeed, but I've come to, I had the great luck to meet as well lawyers from Switzerland, from Germany, from Cambodia itself. So we've had these several discussions with our team of lawyers, who was French, and they had to understand this story, which is quite complex, and the story of Kate inside, which is, it's like a bit the Russian dolls, but for someone who doesn't know what has been going on. So, it's one more challenge, you see? And then our relation to the country. I mean, my mom's relation, my relation to the country. Since we are, she's considered as a foreigner, though she speaks, writes down and understands pretty well the Khmer language. And I myself look Cambodian, but I don't really speak Cambodian, though a few words would light up when people speak, you know. So we don't have the same competencies in relation to the country, so to speak. So multiple challenges for both sides. And as you know, it's not, certainly not the most cherry of topics, but in the story itself, I think it's very interesting. We have a link with people who are very interested in this story, which is also the story of mankind. Cambodia is not only the story of Cambodia. I think it's something much bigger. And so it takes the right questions for them to ask us, the right reactions, the right words. And those were really difficult to find after 30 years, I can tell you that. 30 years of silence, because it took 30 years, you can say so, for the trial to be set. Most of the people died in between. Most of the witnesses disappear, whether naturally or not. And I'm not sure that the civil party can ever be ready for what expects them. But I'm sure that the respect of a certain ethical language is something essential in the feeling of complete security for a civil party or any witness.
Yeah, can you tell us more about that? Like, do you have any examples of where ethical language either was used effectively or needed to be?
So as I was telling you, I've had the luck to assist several audiences of DOIC. Previously, I had to testify as a civil party. And it was very hard for me at the start because I started to watch him behind a TV screen. And that's how I realized who he was, what was his state of mind, how he was drinking, how his hand was disabled, how the camera lenses were projected in a certain way that he had probably been deciding of much onward, the tribunal was set. And so I realized what I could do, what I couldn't, so the limits I had, in a way.
Yeah.
And I also assisted the audiences inside the courtroom in the public gallery. And I think by the time he knew who I was, he knew I was about to testify. And there is that moment in the book we wrote down, that's called When the Clouds Fell from the Sky, from Robert Carmichael, where I described very well that I just went down the stairs and Dirk was standing up in front of me, hands in the pockets, and you know, he was just staring at me. And the more I was coming towards him, the smaller I was, and the higher he was looking me down, you know. And to me, it was very impressive at first, but I was accompanied that day, and I felt like with the bulletproof glass, you know, in fact, he was just able to do nothing. So it was this kind of experience, because it was very strong. All the more I was, I think I was the youngest civil party for Doig's trial, at least. And I was, I think, 32 at the time. For me, it was very impressive. There is also another moment that we don't see. We don't know how the court is built, but inside there were two entries. Sorry, one for the witnesses, and one for the accused. I mean, inside the court, but it was outside. And there's a moment, I don't know how it happened, but I found myself face to face with Doig. He was inside the UN car. And I looked right and left and I was alone. And actually, each time I arrived, I was whether in a bus with every civil parties surrounded with an escort. There was always escort people inside the trial, inside the gallery around me. I remember when the first time I went to the trial, the door was opened by a Russian escort, and inside there was Ali as well, always looking at if we were fine and so on. I know there was people caring about my life, you know.
Yeah.
And this time it did not happen. I was alone outside, and I really felt very small once again. So these are two moments that I don't think I can ever forget.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not dealing with the confrontation itself inside the trial at the moment I was testifying, but just to tell you, it's something very impressive. So it takes this ethical language to go back to the people we are dealing with to feel secure. And I think this is really, really important.
Yeah, yes. Now that makes a lot of sense. Something a lot of the attorneys we've talked to, both the people who worked with civil parties, but also people from all parts of the court, prosecution, defense, a lot of them have mentioned how impressed they were with a lot of the witnesses and civil parties who, you know, did have to go up and stand in front of the court and give their statement, and how, you know, some of them, like you, were perhaps more used to like how court proceedings work, but also very many of them, having been in Cambodia and having gone through many, many years of war, had never experienced anything even remotely like that before, and how they all, a lot of them have said how impressed they were that people who were not super educated were able to get up and still give their statements in front of a court that a lot of people thought was really intimidating. I wonder if, since you went through this, if you got a sense of whether, how hard it was for other civil parties, perhaps for some of the ones that were less educated and less familiar with how court proceedings work, how challenging it would be for them to do what you guys had to do.
I do have an idea of what it represents for someone who is, as you say, I've had the chance to grow up in France. I was educated, but you know, that doesn't mean they don't have a feeling of what's right and wrong. And I know they have a great perception in Cambodia, which is a very delicate population. They have a very strong sense of what it represents of having been doing harm to their own family, their own siblings, and I see what you mean. They keep it for themselves, that they don't really express. It's very hard to express, first of all, after a genocide, how you've been grieving, and it's very hard as well. I think very difficult to express yourself in front of a court is very impressive when it's not any kind of people you've ever been dealing with in your life.
Yeah,
it's a certain vocabulary. Mm-hmm. It's a very strong feelings that come to the surface, and maybe themselves they haven't had time before onwards to understand what their own feelings were. I mean, they've been stolen their own siblings, families, or whoever it is, and they don't even know what it does to them. I mean, they would feel it, but you have to put words on this. And this is not very easy as well. So I think it's important to have people supporting you in that way. Yeah. And yes, I all the more realize that I've been witnessing myself that the previous months I had to testify. I think the jury itself was very harsh with the witnesses, telling them, come on, recompose, when they started crying. And I think this is very hard a sentence to hear when you've been dealing with 30 years wandering. I wouldn't say grieving or suffering, I would say wandering, because most of the time, if you know the truth, okay, you've got the mass atrocities, places like Chang Ek, you've got S21 transformed as a museum that you can see nowadays. But I mean, it can never tell you anything about how it's going on inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, I do have an idea, yeah, of how people have been feeling in Cambodia, but also with the foreign civil parties. All the more Rob Hamill, who I've come to know very well, and I know how it feels for a foreigner to. I can't think both sides, actually.
Right.
I know how it feels for a local person and how it feels for a foreigner to wonder, why did they do harm to my brother? Was it because he was white? Was it because he had a boat? Was it because he was rich? And from the local part, I would say most of them really understood the part of the, what we call in French, la lutte des classes, because communism, I mean, the Khmerus is all about communism. So they understood maybe the more closely the political part.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. So the ECCC was the first international tribunal that included civil parties. Do you think that future courts handling mass atrocities should include them as well, based on your experience?
The thing is, we're seldom aware of all the work that I was telling about that previously is done by juries, researchers, witnesses, organizations, like a bit. Organizations I didn't know myself before coming to the trial, like TPO, ADOC, the DC camp that I really, really thank. And even after I came to know Human Rights Watch. So, you know, there's a certain amount of work being done for international trials that are set, but it gives an audience, and I think a huge realistic, or how could I tell that, pragmatical side to see the real people, the survivors, you know, to understand. I think it's important, yes, to have the victim, be the perpetrators or victims. I think it's crucial. It's a crucial point. All the more at the time when Cambodia was struggling with evictions and the arrival of the modern world inside the capital itself. I've seen it myself. I've got used plenty of photographs of that. And I think Cambodia was struggling at the same time with deep emotions inside the trial itself and outside in the capital city at the same time. So that's quite a remarkable timing, I must say.
Yeah.
I think it's...
Sorry, I cut out on that last sentence there. Can you say it again?
I said, I think, yes, it was crucial to have witnesses in an international trial. Yes.
Great. Well, thinking maybe forward then, if civil parties are included in future tribunals, again, just based on your experience, do you have any advice for future courts about any improvements they might make for the process of being a civil party?
Well, their participation has been a real challenge. I'm not just talking for myself. I think I can speak because I know many civil parties.
Yeah.
And so I know it's been a real challenge for all the civil parties. And it had to be first organized and everything. From a general point of view, it was observed, I think, by many hundreds of Cambodians every day. I was told that afterwards, that it was spread on TV channels inside the country itself and all the countryside areas had seen the witnesses speak. And so buses have been taken for the people to come to see maybe even a small part inside the public gallery itself, but also all around the country, there is an amount of information that has been given the opportunity for the Cambodian to have access to that. So in the outdoor, what you don't see is the media section of the trial itself, transports, meeting points and spaces. I mean, it's all crisscrossed in a limited amount of time. And well, yes, I think it would be essential to give a voice to the civil parties in the coming international tribunals. I'm expecting this particularly for the survivors of Said Naya in Syria, and also other people in these cases. And I expect organizations like the Slokrit Institute, Civicus Maxima, or Bopana Center in Cambodia to work jointly, even for a genocide occurring like this, because the industry of crime is having always, we feel like, one step onwards, as if we were surprised, but now we know how it works.
Right.
So if there is a business in the industry of crime, we know how to counter it. And I would expect this kind of organization, yes, to work jointly. Yes.
Yeah, I know DCCAM has done work connecting other genocides that have happened as well. And I know a few of the people who we've spoken to who worked at the ETRC have gone on to work on the investigative mechanisms in Syria and Myanmar and other places. So hopefully we're learning. and hopefully that will make a difference. What do you think about the reparations that were ultimately implemented by the court? Did you feel like they addressed your needs or that they addressed the needs kind of more for Cambodia in general?
Let's say from a personal perspective, to me, there was no real other option but testify in confrontation with Doc. That was the aim. Mm-hmm. For me.
Sure.
From the start, the US, Thailand, and Vietnam were out and not supposed to be convicted, out any conviction. And there would be no personal reparation. So I suggested to write down the names of those identified in S21, carved in the stone, which is also a collective reparation. And as only suggested by the court previously. So from the scale of the country itself, things have improved all of a sudden, I think. You can see that Phnom Penh is developing quite quickly right now. And the population is very young. And I think, yes, things were a bit way too much decided on words, I think. So from a personal scale, I went through what I wanted. And I think it's an extreme privilege to have been able to be confronted to the murder of my dad face to face, because it's not something that happens very often. It's not something that we've seen very often in history. So from that point of view, yes, I'm very lucky. Even though it was impressive.
Right. No, I'm glad that there were good results to what I can only imagine is a very, very challenging experience. Thinking forward a bit, what do you think the impacts of the ECCC will be for Cambodian society, both today and perhaps 20 years in the future?
With all what happened inside the trial itself, I would say, and once again, what happened in the trial reflects, I think, very well what's going on outside at the moment, and also, as you're asking, for the coming years. It required a certain mindset, because the people don't make any gifts to you when you speak about your own history. Mm-hmm. Even though we're talking today, I mean, on the moment, I've heard people telling me that the trial was not relevant at the moment, and then they came back realizing that they didn't know what they were talking about, simply. So in those terms, of course, of education, I think it's going to be the key to understand the story of the genocide. What happened in Cambodia is also something to take into account for any genocide. And it's gonna help them to decide where they wanna go as a young and increasing population, you know? Like for instance, the Ratanakiri population is disappearing, as you may know. And I'm not sure with the modern society, they're going to be given a chance in Cambodia to to know who they are. And I think this was a great opportunity to give them back their own self. Who they are really. They are given back who they are, actually. Because I've been stolen my culture, having seen the living the disappearance of my dad. And with the murder of Kate, there are lots of things we don't know. My grandfather was a majordome. He met Jacqueline Kennedy, and he knew how to cook, things like that. So my culture has been stolen from me. And I think the trial is trying to give back all this to Cambodian, their own story, be it pleasant or unpleasant. And as pleasant or unpleasant as your past can be, you are given the ability to preserve your identity. That's what comes out from the trial, I think. This is the idea. And it surely was important to put words on what happened. So nowadays, the young student pass their degree knowing what's going on in their government. I think they are more able to accept the good and fight the wrong deeds. And of course, on the proceedings, I would have preferred the trial to happen in Netherlands, because I'm very fond of the way Eichmann was taken by the Mossad, for instance. But it happened in Cambodia. It's like that. It's not perfect, and it's always easy to criticize. Now they can decide what they want to do with their own government. They are well aware and given the right tools to rise in spite of all they've been forced to do, because they've been forced to do a lot of things. You can see that in every documentaries of Riti Pan, for instance. He's dealing with many subjects in Cambodia, and you cannot go through the history of Cambodia without getting through his work. You will have an idea of all the matters that Cambodia is going through. And I'm clearly thinking about the future challenges that expects Cambodian people. I'm talking about the murders of Kim Lee and the assassination of Thut Buti. When I say that, because there is going to be quite a lot of challenges to come for Cambodian people. So what we are trying to give them through the trial, I think, it's when I say it's much beyond what's going on in the trial itself, it's about giving them the right tools and bringing education. I think from 7 to 12 now, there is the school program is loaded with the history of Cambodia and what has been going on in the trial. So you cannot pretend, you cannot say, I did not know, like we've heard so many times, after Nuremberg. You cannot do that. It's impossible. If you want to survive the modern world, I wish that they are going to choose to protect life. But now it's all in the hand of the future generations. And they have to choose how they want to interact with the world now. So I've been very lucky. I've met people like Van Natt. I've been talking to Gregory Stanton, who's been organizing everything on Worlds and who's been creating programs on the subjects of the stages of genocide. So I've been very lucky to meet people like that, and I wish it will really help the Cambodian children choose, orient their studies towards reconstruction, rebuild, and how and with what, which way they're going to choose to rebuild. I think this is the best tools that they had. They're going to have to make tomorrow.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you again for sharing all of this with us. I know this is not the first time, even besides the trials, that you've had to think back on all of this. So we really appreciate you doing it for us. Before I let you go, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is important or you'd like to say?
I just want to remind you that we wrote down a book 5 years ago that is on its way to the second version. It's written down by Robert Carmichael. It's called When the Clouds Fell from the Sky. And the second version has been edited with Hachette UK. So it might be translated in French in the years to come, because Hachette also is French. And I mean, it's some of the best inquiry. I've come to read a lot of books on the subject because I was looking for what had happened to my father, and he was completely disappeared. So I found my own story through the story of plenty of other people that I want to thank for having had the courage to speak and to be able later on to write down their own story. So I hope this will help not only for the understanding, but also to make the right choices for Cambodia, because Cambodia is a country that has a strategic position from a geographic point of view in Southeast Asia, but also in the ASEAN. I was in the ASEAN at the moment it started, so I know what I'm talking about. And searching for the truth, you know, it's a whole process. So what you put in is what you get out. And I hope that the young Cambodians will grow inquisitive mind and will decide for the better later on, yes. Because it's not about winning. It's about being able to live together. And I've learned myself that teamwork is also something that can bring you something. Because I've often been going through this story on my own. And it's not about winning, really. It's really, if that things do take time, it's true. And minds change very slowly. Slowly, too slow for me from a personal point of view, of course. But the collective response to any genocide is by far the strongest possible. And it takes quite a number of people to do that. So if there is a positive point to get out from the whole story, yes, it's less a question of judgment than it is a question of education. And I think it's in their hands now.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you again. Appreciate it.